Hi, everybody. This is Todd, fresh back from May 4th, 2012. And let me tell you, the Avengers is awesome. I just wanted to let you know that we've been interviewed by the D History Podcast. That's dhistorypod.wordpress.com. So you can listen to us and our connection about Disney and about how the podcast came to be. And you can, as Alex and Michael talk to us, and you get to listen to Michael grill me all about comic books. All right. Peace out.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Disney Film Project Podcast. This is the program where we discuss the films of the Walt Disney Company, from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs all the way through Prom and beyond. We will discuss the films of the Walt Disney Company and all the myriad and detours that they have taken throughout the years. I'm your host, Ryan Kilpatrick. I am the owner, proprietor, and blogger at DisneyFilmProject.com, where you can read about all the Disney shorts and animated features all the way through 1948 we are at right now. So get up there and start a reading, folks, and catch up with us. Joining me, of course, though, are the people who really make this program what it is, which is hopefully entertaining for all of you, and that is the film buffs that we love because they know a lot more about the Disney films than I could ever hope to. Starting with Mr. Todd Perlmutter, who is a blogger at touringplans.com and chief technical officer at DisneyDrivenLife.com. Hello, Mr. Todd.
Hello, Ryan. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Even though this is a depressing movie, I'm doing well.
Yeah, it's a little depressing, but, you know, at the same time, I mean, it's got a strong, though often missed message, so.
It's got a beat, you can dance to it?
Yeah. I dance to anything, though, so, you know.
Yeah, this is very true.
I don't really count.
Speaking of people who will dance to anything, it's Miss Brianna Alessio, who is attractions blogger at DisneyDrivenLife.com, as well as side blogger at Adventures of Bree at AdventuresofBree.blogspot.com. Hello, Brianna, how are you?
Hello, Ryan. I am busy rehydrating myself after watching this film. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm doing well. Yeah, this is a tearjerker, right?
Oh, indeed. All throughout.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens to be one of those, yes. Although I imagine that our lovely and talented producer probably took it the worst with the cute animals. Miss Cheryl Perlmutter, who edits this together, was this a tearjerker for you, Cheryl?
Actually, no.
Really?
Yes.
I thought this was right up your alley.
I was so distracted by the way the plot moved in this movie.
Yeah, that I understand that.
And
yeah.
So I just didn't get the tear-jerking part. I mean, yeah. It was a little bit sad, but it wasn't like, you know.
She was crying at one point, though.
I was
over.
Not.
Yes, you were.
Todd, I was not. I swear I wasn't. Sorry, guys, he's lying.
Okay. Well, we will get to the bottom of this. We'll get the hidden cameras out and we'll decide. But we are discussing today the 1981 animated feature, The Fox and the Hound, released by Walt Disney Pictures on July 10th of that year. It is the 24th animated film from Walt Disney Productions or the Walt Disney Company or whatever you would like to call it. To say this is somewhat of a transition film, I guess would be the best way to put it. It's the group of animators, the nine old men who basically drove the Disney animated canon through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, even after Walt's death. And that group then, at this time for this film, was giving way to the new group of young folks, some obscure people that you may have not heard of before, like Brad Bird, Tim Burton, John Lasseter, Glenn Keane, Andreas Deja, people like that. Yeah, I know these are obscure names I'm throwing at you, but, you know, those are the folks who were working on this film. Don Bluth, that we can discuss in a little while about his contribution to the movie. But this was the transition film. It was the last one that any of the nine old men worked on. Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston did character designs for the main characters, and Wooly Reitherman produced the movie. But this was the end of an era at Disney, and that caused some issues.
And the beginning at the same time, because it was also the first animated feature that Walt had absolutely no involvement in.
Yep. Yeah, definitely a film that kind of bridged the gap between the old days and the new days. And like I said, that cost a bit of a struggle, let's say that. But the basics, it's The Fox and the Hound is based on a novel by Daniel Mannix, or I guess I should say Daniel P. Mannix. I guess if somebody has their middle initial in their name, that's very important. You have to use it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely. So Daniel P. Mannix wrote a novel that resembles the movie in some way, but not in a great big way.
Barely at all.
Yeah. There's a fox and a hound in the novel.
And a gun.
And a gun.
And winter.
Yeah. That about does it, yeah.
And train tracks.
There's a train, that's right.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, too. But yeah, we can start with the basics of the story of the film, and I'm assuming most people who saw it in the recently re-released Blu-ray or have seen it when they were kids or something. This is one I remember from when I was a kid. I watched this a few times and remembered it much more fondly than I did when I went back and watched it recently. But the basics are: we have Todd the fox, who is adopted by a widow and raised, and then we have Copper the hunting dog, who is being raised by a crotchety old hunter. The two of them become friends, which, as you can imagine, might cause some issues. That's the 10,000 foot view of the plot of this one. That is not the plot of the book that it's based on, to say the least, as we mentioned.
No, so
far from it.
And honestly, that was part of the problems that arose between the old guard and the new guard. So we should probably go into the differences between the book and the movie, and then we can discuss it a little further. But yeah, it's a different thing, because the book is not something you would imagine that Disney would have done.
Right. For starters, no birds. No birds are characters. There's no the animals don't talk in the movies, and I mean the book they do kind of think, and there's this whole thing that Mr. Mannix there he wrote about how he envisioned how animals must think based on human behavior versus their own behavior. He had this whole series of articles about this that get very insane in your head when you're reading them.
I get the feeling Mr. Mannix was a little bit of insane.
Well, can we talk about him for a second? He had...
Please, go right ahead.
Crazy cool life, if you think about it. He was a sword swallower and a fire eater in a carnival trade show, as well as having been in a naval lieutenant in Washington, D.C. during World War II.
Wow.
Okay.
He wrote the famous biography of Aleister Crowley.
Interesting. Okay.
As well as he wrote a work about the Hellfire Club, which is this this like underground Illuminati type club for rich people that started in London.
Okay.
He also also a skilled stage magician, right? And he was a charter member of the International Wizard of Oz Club.
Hey, I think I was part of that too.
So, I mean, it's crazy. He had just a very interesting life in general, in terms of just craziness, not like, you know, not in a real world sense. You know, people, you only read about people having these kinds of lives, like Mr. Biddle. I'm just saying that's who he reminded me of in a lot of ways. Very, you know, an eccentric lifestyle.
I can see that. Okay. Yeah. But the book and the movie, I mean, we mentioned that there's a big discrepancy between the two, because the book is really based on the dog Copper, which I don't even think the dog is named Copper in the book.
Now, the dog is named Copper, but the dog's names are reversed.
Okay. So
their roles are reversed, I guess, is the correct way to think of it.
Gotcha. Yeah, so Copper is the chief from the movie, and Chief is the younger dog in the book. The book is really about I don't even know how to summarize it. It's honestly sort of the reverse of the movie. Like, you know, the movie spends equal time with the fox and the hound. The book is all about the hound, really, because Todd, the fox, accidentally kills the younger dog, Chief, in the similar way that happens with the movie, with the train tracks and everything. And the rest of the book is Copper trying to hunt down Todd, the older dog, trying to hunt down Todd to kill him.
Wait, let's not say... I want to get on something here. Let's not say that anybody killed anybody or hurt anybody, because they chose to chase the fox. They didn't have to listen to their master and do it. They chose to. So it was a choice, not killing. So I don't know. So
that touches on the actual theme of the movie, Cheryl.
Yeah, that's very true. Which is Mr. Todd.
Oh, okay. So the actual point of the movie is that they were trying to get across to younger kids that you don't have to conform to society necessarily, that you can forge your own way and you don't have to listen to what people are telling you necessarily, but make your own choices and decisions, just make them good ones.
Correct. Which is an interesting thing to say to kids when you're trying to get them to behave, but, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And how it relates to the movie is that every, you know, Copper and in the movie, Copper and Todd want to be friends. Okay.
Right.
But everybody around them doesn't want them to be friends.
Correct. Yeah, I mean it's a different movie for Disney. Like, you know, most of their movies, they may have a message, but it's not kind of overt like that. You know what I mean? Like it's just most of them are more about the happily ever after than about, you know, changing people's behavior or, you know, don't act this way, that kind of a thing. This is probably the most message type movie. You know, WALL-E is the only other one I can think of that's on that level.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not in your face, but it's there kind of thing.
Yeah, like you're not going to walk away from the movie not understanding the message, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But so that's what the book is much darker, let's say that, than the film, and focuses much more on Copper hunting down Todd and, you know, trying to take revenge for the death of Chief. So it focuses much more on that aspect of the story, and they're not friends in the book. That's a key difference as well.
Right. I mean, they haven't even really met outside of the Hound versus Fox realm,
right,
you know, hunting realm.
Yeah.
Isn't this similar to what happened with Mary Poppins when the novel was written by P.L. Travers? Didn't Disney have to change some of that because of how morbid she was?
Yeah, they changed quite a lot of it. I mean, remember there was a whole thing we discussed where she had intense problems with the movie.
Right. So
yeah.
I remember there was a whole argument between them, yeah.
There wasn't really this problem. That problem, you know, between the creator and the studio didn't occur here. Because there's nothing that talks about any involvement of his in the movie at all.
No. I don't think... Honestly, the struggles were not between the author and the studio. The struggles were internal at the studio.
Yes, definitely.
To say the least. So, yeah. And the big point, the difference between the movie and the book that caused such a problem was the fact that Chief in the book dies. If you remember watching the movie, movie Chief gets hit by the train, plummets, what, hundreds of feet into the river, thousands, and wakes up and just has a hurt paw.
Yeah.
And if that seems unrealistic to you, then you would fall in the Don Bluth, Brad Bird, Tim Burton camp. Because at the time the movie came out, when they were working on the film, those guys were very insistent that Chief needed to die in order to add weight to the movie. And among other things, there was lots of other reasons that they were unhappy.
Yeah, but Art Stevens said, no, he's not going to die.
And why did he say that?
Because he just didn't want an on-screen death.
because it's a Disney movie. That's exactly what he said. He said to them, it's a Disney movie. We don't kill the main characters.
Yeah.
Did he watch B&B?
She was killed off screen. And the mother's killed off screen here, too.
In the first 5 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah. Before any speaking parts, too. No, but it's like, you have to, you know, there's Trusty in Lady and the Tramp, right? Same thing, right? You think he's dead, and then, boom, he's back alive.
Isn't that one of the they did that in Jungle Book, too.
They did it in Tangled.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, Tangled, they kind of telegraph it from the beginning, though, because he starts off talking about how he's dead.
Yeah.
True, but they did... I mean, but they did the same exact thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's something that they do quite a bit in Disney movies.
Yes.
You know, he's dead. And, oh, wait, no, he's fine. He's okay.
It's a trend. They want to bring you to your lowest point and then all of a sudden bring you right back up again and say, yay!
Yep. Yeah. That's exactly it.
That's what they do.
But, yeah, Bree, you mentioned the fox dying in the first 5 minutes. And, Cheryl, you mentioned Bambi's death. And this reminded me a lot of that. Or Bambi's mother's death, I should say. And this reminded me a lot of that right in the very beginning, you know, with the mother being shot off screen, like we said. And then Todd is adopted by the widow Tweed and meets the kind of the side supporting characters, Big Mama, played by Pearl Bailey, and then Boomer, the voice of Tigger, Paul Winchell, and Dinky, Dick Bakalyan. And Boomer and Dinky, by the way, was another source of contention between the younger animators and the older ones. Because they're in the younger animators' ideas, the Boomer and Dinky added nothing to the film, and I have to say I agree.
I totally disagree.
Well,
they
you're
totally
wrong.
they were great. They were great. I loved them. I really did.
I think it's more fair to say though that they didn't add anything to the story, but they had their own story.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't play a role in the film, right? They could have had their own short, and it would have been wildly entertaining. Like, if you cut all of their sequences of them chasing the bug out and, you know, left it in its own, 15-minute short, probably would have been really entertaining. But in this movie, like, tone-wise and everything, it just doesn't fit very well.
Yeah, I like it. I did like the scenes with them, but I agree. They don't... You could just take them out and you get the same movie, so...
But I have to say I agree with the other side. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was some great comic relief in there in a sad movie.
I'm on the fence about them. I don't know.
I don't dislike them. I just don't think they fit with the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm on the side of Brad Bird and Tim Burton, and Cheryl's on the side of, like, old guys. Of course, those are the old guys who animated Snow White, so it shows you what I know.
And nowadays, those young guys are old guys.
Yeah, that's true. That is kind of...
Oh,
that's
wow.
Weird, isn't it?
But funny how it works.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
So, and then that's kind of the beginning of the movie, but the real first act is Todd and Copper becoming friends. And this is the part that I think... to my mind, I think they do a really great job with, because it's pretty obvious that they don't have anything in common. And it's you know, watching it back this time, I used to think in my mind when I had thought of this movie, I thought, oh, they spend a lot of time playing together, but they really don't.
No.
In the grand scheme of the movie, but it comes across as though they did.
Well, you know why? Because before you watched it recently, when was the last time you had watched it?
Probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Right. Now, here's the thing. It'd been a while since I'd watched it, too. But the important thing is that when you see scenes for the movie, you never see the adult Todd and Copper. You always see the kids. So in your head, you kind of map it out that that's what they do. They play all the time because that's all you ever see them doing when you see advertisements for the movie and whatnot, because I guess really there's only the movie. They're like have no presence in any of the theme parks or anything like that. So
yeah, no, that's true. I mean, yeah, this movie kind of disappeared after it was released. Now, Brie, had you seen this before we watched it this time?
Not in its entirety. I'd only seen bits and pieces, which is why I wasn't really looking forward to seeing this whole thing, because as I've mentioned before, I'm an extremely emotional person, and pretty much anything makes me cry.
Understood.
And this did live up to that.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Can we talk about my problems with this part of the plot?
With the two of them playing together?
Yeah.
Okay. So Big Mama, the owl, sets up Todd the Fox, not Todd my husband, Todd the Fox, to live with the old lady Tweed.
Yes.
And then he grows up. I think she sees Copper move in. I don't recall this or not. So, and then my problem is they do the whole singing of they can't be friends later. Like after them playing everything, why doesn't she tell them, like, beforehand they can't be friends?
She's eyeing the situation, right? There's a whole, if you pay attention, she's almost always when they're playing, she's up in the tree nearby going, that's like all she ever does in the tree, right? Because she's surprised that it's happening too, that she's surprised that the natural, what she deems to be the natural instinct isn't taking over. But that's again, that goes back to the theme of the movie. The point is that's not natural, that's what they're taught.
But then after she says, and she sings the whole song about you can't be friends. So she knows they can't be friends. So why does she even let it get to that part?
She thinks they can't be friends. Because that's what she's taught. That's the point.
Right. She thinks they can't be friends, but she's also kind of curious that this is even going on, just like Todd said. I mean, she's definitely watching the situation. And it gets to a point where she tells them, you know, it's not going to work out. But she's watching this going, why is this happening? What's going on? You know, what can I do? Should I do anything? You know, she's conflicted. You can kind of see it. Like Todd said, when she's sitting in the tree, they're kind of watching them play.
Yeah. I just think it should have happened a little earlier.
Well, that's actually a lot of people's...
And not letting it go as far as it did.
It's actually a lot of people's problem with the movie. It, to begin with, is that it takes so long to get to the actual story, which this is when Amos takes the dogs and goes on the hunting trip, the movie actually, that's when the movie really actually kicks into what the movie.
Right.
Okay. Up until that point, it's a lot of people and critics feel that it's very drawn out.
No, I don't disagree with them.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with them either. It's odd because, like you said, why... You know, going back to what you're saying, is you would think from watching the videos that half the movie is the kids playing with each other, and it's not.
No, not at all.
Okay. And so why does it take so long to get to the point of them being adults then?
Good point.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not a – it's not a perfect film for sure.
No.
I mean, it has a lot of issues, I think. But – from an emotional standpoint, like if you don't go and analyze it from a plot standpoint, it tugs at the heartstrings in the right places. Because, like we mentioned, after they, you know, after we have this whole thing of them being kids, you know, there's you get the intervention of Slade the hunter who keeps Copper in chief, and the confrontation between he and the widow Tweed, basically saying that, you know, these two don't need to be together. That's not what they're saying, but that's the message being delivered to us as the viewer. And then they grow into adulthood where things are way different because Slade takes Copper off and he becomes a grown-up. Todd grows up. And when they see each other again, they're very different at that point. They've already sort of evolved, especially Copper. Todd's still a little bit the way he had been, but Copper is definitely different because he's been on this hunting trip.
Right.
And that's the point at which we get to the controversial scene, at least internally at Disney, with Todd and the railroad bridge, Chief chasing him and Chief getting hit by the train, falling millions of feet to his apparent death, which is apparently not his death. I have to say, this is an occasion where I Although I think it could have been powerful to see Chief's death, I do agree with the not having the on-screen death and letting him live. I could see where it would be more powerful for him to die, but I don't know. It just seems, especially with the tone of the rest of the movie, it just seemed, I don't know. It seemed like it was a good transition point.
But if here's the thing, right, is him lying in the water and the way Copper reacts to it, right, you wouldn't know unless the hunt, except that the hunter says you almost killed Chief, and then you see Chief later laid up in the room, right? If you didn't have those two scenes, you would have thought he was dead anyway.
Correct. So the scene that happens later with Chief in the room with his paw bandaged and he's wobbling around, to me, that scene is too funny for the rest of that part of the movie. Like, it's a very comic scene of him, you know, nobody's paying attention to me and all this kind of stuff. But it doesn't fit with the rest of the movie at that point. The rest of the movie has gone very dark and very emotional, and here right. he is clowning around after he'd been hit by a train. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems a little off.
You know, there's one important thing that we didn't discuss about the difference between the book and the movie.
Yes, sir.
Right? So, you know how we were talking about how Chief lives versus dies in the book, right? Well, yes, actually, sir. The truth of the matter is that all the characters live versus
die. That's a very good point. Very good point, yes.
And I think it's important to note that Copper, Todd, Chief, Todd has two wives, there's no name given to either of them, and two complete litters of children, and they all die in the book.
Wow. Yep. There you have it, people.
So, there's a lot of saving going on by Disney in this particular case.
Todd the Fox is quite a ladies' man.
In the book.
Yeah, well... Yeah. He manages to meet and seduce Vixie in, you know, 5 minutes.
I have to say, though, how cute is that scene? That scene is really cute.
It is cute. And it's good. The voice acting, too, is pretty good. I mean, Mickey Rooney plays the grown-up Todd returning to Disney from Pete's Dragon, and Sandy Duncan, which, before we saw this, how long had it been since you'd thought of Sandy Duncan?
Not since a while, yeah.
What movie was she? What TV show was she in? She was in some TV show.
Yeah.
The Hogan.
Ooh. Yes. Yep.
I was looking at this and it's Sandy Duncan. Wow, that's a name from the past, you know? But she plays Vixie, and the two of them together, you know, their voice acting I thought was pretty good. I did not, by the way, think Kurt Russell was particularly great as Copper. I don't know what you guys thought.
I wasn't sold on it.
No. So.
Yeah. It's interesting because, and by the way, the other interesting voice cast in this movie that I love is Corey Feldman as the young Copper.
Yes, perfect. The two that played the young Todd and young Copper were very good.
Yes. But, so we said Vixie, you know, Vixie apparently now makes him grow up because he as Cheryl mentioned, and she is the one who then gets into trouble as Copper is chasing Todd with the hunter. And she is also the one that Todd has to go and rescue from a bear attack, which is the kind of the climactic scene between he and Copper and Vixie and the bear. Oh, my.
Yeah, the bear attack was another one of those scenes that was a problem scene for the studio.
Yeah.
It was because Glenn Keane didn't like the way the old men plotted it out, and he completely redid it.
And I have to say, from an animation perspective, he did a heck of a job.
It's really nice, actually.
I mean, it's credited in lots of, you know, if you look at read a lot of books about animation, like that sequence is one of those that they write about, like the crows from Dumbo or the pink elephants on parade or some of the other, you know, famous sequences from days of past. This one is one that they also will put into that pantheon.
You know, what it reminded me of is the scene, Todd, the scene from Brother Bear, where they actually killed the bear.
Actually, you know why I thought that too is just the initial scene where the bear comes out and its eyes are red and that whole thing, that I kind of felt the same way there. Yeah. He had wanted to use charcoal to do the scene, but it would have taken too long because it has to have a shelf life before it can be colored when you do charcoal. Mm-hmm. So they did it with pencil, but he still did really heavy lines of pencil. And it kind of sort of, I mean, while it wasn't the silhouetted battle that you get in Lady of the Tramp, it reminded me of that too because of the camera angles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
One of the bits of trivia is that the bear snarl is a rehash from Shere Khan and Nero the Crocodile.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Now, to talk a little bit about Don Bluth. Now, wasn't this mentioned in Waking Sleeping Beauty? This film about the production being delayed for a year.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. If anybody knows Don Bluth, you know, like, probably now it would be difficult to know him, but he was an animator at the studio during this time, worked on all the major films. And during production of Fox and the Hound, he finally just had enough. The chief's death change was probably the straw that broke the camel's back, but he had several other problems with the movie, such as the bear sequence that Todd mentioned. You know, lots of different things. And one day just came to the studio and said, I'm leaving. And he left along with a friend of his. And then the next day, 11 more animators left. And they went
actually,
on
it was
to
two,
form...
It was two guys. It was Goldman and Pomeroy.
Oh, that's right. Goldman
resigned at the same time as him.
Yeah. And then the next day, 11 more guys left.
Yep.
And they formed the new studio. And that's the studio that would put out Secret of NIMH and Land Before Time and those movies that you guys probably have seen before. And yeah, that the loss of that many animators is what ended up shutting production on this film for a long time, because it was supposed to come out in 1980 and it ended up coming out in 1981. Because at the time, Disney had gone from, in the heyday, they had 400 animators, and at this time it was down, I think, under 100.
So, after they left, I think it was under 100. It wasn't just the 11. Then a whole bunch of other people left too, for other things, because they just didn't want it anymore. So they had to really fill the ranks back up.
Yeah.
But isn't this when when CalArts was basically formed because of this, right?
Well, CalArts had been in existence before.
Right.
This.
But it became. But Disney threw a whole lot of money at them and turned it into a much bigger school because of this, because they needed more animators, right?
There had already been a program at CalArts. So John Lasseter, Brad Bird, Tim Burton, all those guys had gone through the CalArts program,
right?
And graduated. But it was a very small program. You know, there were probably 20, 30 folks in the program at a certain time, if I remember correctly. And if I don't, please somebody correct my information. But from what I remember from my readings, at the time that this movie came out, that was a very tiny program. And they then went in and said, hey, we need to expand this program and see if we can get more people and beef up our animation staff. That didn't last, but they did try to do it. But yeah, the split that happened there was really kind of what messed up the movie, really. Because you can see, I think we would all agree, there's a good movie here. It's just the tone kind of shifts so much throughout the film that it's difficult to kind of latch in, because, you know, the early part of the film is so sweet and touching, which it has to be in order to give the emotional weight to the end. But then at the end, there's a very dark tone, and we have these, you know, comical pieces with Chief or romance with Vixie and things like that that kind of change things.
Right.
Yeah.
It was also, I mean, this whole event, too, was one of the catalysts for the 1984 takeover, too. One of them. Not all of them, but just the fact that they needed to whip the studio back into shape. So this was it, you know. Because Ron Miller was ousted in 84 and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important film, right? Because of that. All the different things that happened in this movie would then lead to different things in the future. You know, the departure of of those animators is one of the things that helped Ron Clements and John Musker get the job taking The Great Mouse Detective and steering that. And those guys would go on to do The Little Mermaid and, you know, the other films that they've done at Disney. So it's a very important film. I think it suffers as a film because of all the things that happened, you know, behind the scenes.
So I really like this article that I read that discussed the whole excess, which I'll include in the show notes. But it's got this little part that talks about how Bluth was kind of sort of revered at the studio right before he left. And they actually called it the Bluthies versus the Mouseketeers. Okay.
And, yeah, nice.
And literally, because they were not proponents of Donald Bluth, Bill Croyer, Brad Bird, Henry Selick, and John Musker used to sit in this area called that the people who follow Bluth would call the rat's nest.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it was so bad and so vile what was going on, you know.
But, I mean, can you ponder the amount of talent that is sitting there working on this movie? I mean, so, for people who don't follow the intricacies of, you know, who's behind the camera or who's working on the different films, I mean, Brad Bird is the guy who directed Ratatouille. He directed The Incredibles. He directed a movie from Fox called The Iron Giant, which, if you haven't seen, is an amazing film, animated, hand-drawn animated film. So, you know, big-name director, right?
Yes.
Henry Selick, the director of Nightmare Before Christmas, among mm-hmm. many other things. Tim Burton, I think, I would hope everyone who's a movie fan knows. John Lasseter, again, if you're a Disney fan, I would hope you know that name. Clements and Musker, we just talked about. Glenn Keane, who we've talked about on previous shows, was the, you know, lead animator on Gaston and many other things.
One of the connections to Glenn Keane that many people may not know, and I didn't realize this till recently, till I look him up, is that he also co-animates the Daily Strip Family Circus with Bill Keane. Billy is the youngest, the oldest son in the Family Circus is actually modeled upon him.
Yeah, because he's Bill Keane's son, yeah. Just so everybody understands
yes.
that.
There you go.
Also, let's not forget Lorna Cook, who is one of the most famous female animators in the world, basically. Bill and Sue Croyer, you know, was Fern Gully, you know, and on and on and on. So
this is probably the most talent-packed Disney film ever made. I mean, seriously, if you think about all of those guys from the new breed and then the older breed, so Wooly Reitherman, who was a producer on the movie, was one of Walt's nine old men, worked on pretty much everything from the 40s on. Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, again, if you're a Disney fan, I would hope you know those guys, but, you know, lead animators on tons and tons and tons of films.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a slam-packed full of talent movie, which I guess is probably why it ended up, you know, having people not be able to get along.
I have a different question. How did the actors handle when this animation thing happened? I mean, the voice actors. Because we have some people here that are new, like Kurt Russell. I mean, he met Walt, I think, once, he said. But we have Mickey Rooney, who is in Pete's Dragon. We have a couple other people that have done some other films. So I wonder how the actor... Does anyone know how the actors handled this? Because
nobody
such
really.
An excess would have... Well, I mean... It would have been weird because, you know, obviously you have one person watching you draw and then, you know, next day it's someone else.
At this point, first of all, like the younger roles, Keith Coogan and Corey Feldman, by the time this was all going on, all their stuff had already been recorded and canned. So they were not, it was just a matter of putting art to their voices. I don't know about anyone else. I never really read anything else.
No, I haven't, and I would imagine a lot of them had probably already recorded their voice work before some of this went down, because they record their voice work ahead of time. Now, I would imagine the main characters, you know, like Kurt Russell or Mickey Rooney, they probably had to come back in and redo stuff, but I don't know, it's a good question, though.
Yeah, can I just say one funny thing? So when you research a movie and you're hitting all these pages, especially like at IMDb and stuff like that, you always read up on the actors' pasts, and I find it strange to me that Mickey Rooney's picture on his IMDb page is younger than Kurt Russell's. I'm just
that is amusing.
That is.
Yeah, I honestly, guys, I don't have a whole lot else to say about this because it's as long of a movie as it is, and you know, there's just not a lot of story to it. The story's very compact. You know, it's they become friends, the incident happens, and then they're not friends until, you know, again, the bear incident when they can't be friends anymore, but they come to a peace with one another.
Yeah,
it's pretty compact, pretty tight.
So one of the other cute things I loved was how the worm was actually a caterpillar and he turned it into a butterfly. That was so cute.
Yay!
Yeah, I had a problem with how long the butterfly, the caterpillar lived for, because he's 2 years, right? Is how long this movie is approximately, and he's like
pretty
the
much,
longest
yeah.
lived caterpillar ever in the creation of the universe.
He's a magical caterpillar.
Yeah, he must be somehow related to Jiminy Cricket.
Hey, he's a Disney caterpillar.
Yeah.
That you never see again outside this movie.
Yeah.
Hey, well, maybe you see the butterfly and you don't know.
Yeah, probably in Alice in Wonderland, right? Oh, wait, that happened before this.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
maybe
he could be a time
Alice
traveler.
In Rye. Yeah.
Maybe he's a time traveling caterpillar.
A time traveling that's where the glowing. Oh, because he got electrically jolted, just like in Back to the Future with the lightning bolt. Time travel.
See?
Wow.
That makes sense. That just happened, folks.
Yeah, it did.
Yep.
Time traveling caterpillars, people.
And my other problem was with the widow helping Slade at the end there.
What's your problem there?
So my problem is, why in the heck is she helping him when he was the one who actually, you know, sent him off?
How many farmhouses do you see there?
Not my problem.
Yeah, well, it's just him and Har- it's just him and Har alone in the woods.
His problem.
I did not take it as a I took it as she is trying to be the bigger person. That's the way I took it.
Yeah, that may be, but you know, there's probably something going on there too. I mean, he's not. I guess he's not a traditional villain, right?
No, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah, Sheev was more of the villain because he was the one who actually told Carpenter he had to think mean.
Yeah, that's true. But then he wasn't that bad, you know what I mean? Like, he was clowning around with his broken paw.
Yeah, no, he was fine. Well, maybe he had a turn of appeal there. I don't know. Again, it's how they were raised, right? And it's how you perceive things, right? I mean, a hunter is not a bad person because he's a hunter, okay?
Right.
Because I'm not particularly for hunting. I'm not going to really pick up a gun and go hunting, okay? But just because I don't like hunting, well, there's somebody else out there who likes hunting. Okay, and this is just a guy who likes to hunt. He has dogs to hunt. That's what he does. That's part of his lifestyle and his living. Just like she's milking the cows for milk and bringing it into town to sell. Okay.
What if the villain in this movie is society?
It is. The villain is society.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, that's definitely the way the theme of the movie is. I mean, you can't... You know, it's the beginning of political correctness. This is the beginning of the political correct movement, this movie.
Yeah.
There you go.
I had a little bit of a problem with this film because I am against hunting, but as you were saying, I'm not against hunters. If they go out and hunt for food, you know, I'm perfectly fine with that. I just have a problem with people hunting and leaving their bodies there and just for fun.
Well, I have problems with people who hunt not for food but for treasure.
Exactly.
Like animal like Animal Kingdom.
Oh. I thought you meant like Nicolas Cage in National Treasure.
No, I meant like the people who are taking Big Red over Animal Kingdom.
Right. Well, I mean, but
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, where in the world was the warden during the scene where they break into the game preserve.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good point. The time period suggests that they should have been a lot of park rangers around in that game preserve, protecting the animals, checking out that they're okay and not having problems. And you know, when a gunshot or 20 are heard, you'd think someone would come running and do their job, and it's just not happening.
No, I really didn't. Yeah, I had that problem too. I was like, shouldn't somebody be doing something somewhere around here?
I can get that back then when you cut the wire, there wasn't like an alarm that went off. I understand that part of it. You know, nowadays those things, you know, they're heavily protected. But, sure. You know, again, though, remember though, like I was saying, it was Slade's livelihood, right? He comes back from that first hunting trip and his entire truck there is filled to the brim with hides from the various things that he's killed, including many fox hides, if you look closely at it.
Yeah, yes. True. That was kind of disturbing, I have to say. Seeing that, like, when you're one of your main characters is already... I mean, I know that's the way the movie was going, but still, it's still a little odd, I would say. Here's the skins of one of our main characters.
It's just like in 101 Dalmatians, where Cruella is trying to kill the dogs to make a coat out of them.
Right, but in 101 Dalmatians, you don't actually see the pelts of the dogs, you know, before she's trying to do this. It just seemed a little weird.
Well, yeah. Well, you don't actually see the foxes he kills either, so, either.
It's true. You don't get to personalize the foxes.
That's right.
It was uncomforting, let's just say that.
He's not really an evil person. He's just a jerk with a gun. You know, and that's the bottom line. And so, you know... It's the way it goes, right? I mean, you know, some people are just not, you know, people you like, and he's one of them. I mean, he gets his due in a lot of ways, right? I mean, he steps in his own trap, which is a very, very Disney theme, right? For villains to end up in their own trap,
yeah,
to some degree, right? So it's, you know, he gets his due.
And he gets attacked by the bear.
He gets attacked by the bear.
Mm-hmm. And that's never good.
No. Bears are big and mean. Not really. See, again, the society thing.
That's right. It's all society making those bears eat people.
That's right.
That's all it is.
Gentle Ben. What more do you need to know?
Oh, Gentle Ben. What a show.
All right. Anyway.
Grizzly Adams.
Grizzly Adams, yes.
Yeah.
So, what about the music? How do people feel about that?
Man.
Yeah, man. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it was nice. I really think that when you put Pearl Bailey in a role, you have her sing more. That was kind of sort of my problem with it. I mean, she sings a lot, but the songs are all less than 2 minutes long. Right?
I think they were struggling with whether they wanted it to be a musical or not, which is something that Disney struggles with a lot in their animated films. Like, I've noticed this since Sleeping Beauty or those movies, and especially, you know, now they struggle with it since the success of, you know, the Aladdins and those Broadway style movies in the early 90s. Like, I think they were struggling with how much music to put in it. It's something that they constantly mess with, and I don't know. I don't think they've found a good balance yet.
It's supposed to be the tear-jerking moment in the movie, and it is a tear-jerking moment in the movie, but the fact that it's a song drives me nuts is when she's driving Todd off to the game preserve.
Worst scene ever. Oh.
The words of the song are very poignant, but they made it a song, and it would have been more meaningful had she actually been talking with him.
Yeah. No, it would have been meaningful had we actually seen the scenes that they showed us the pictures of.
What do you mean?
Okay, so they showed, like, Todd's birthday. And they showed a picture of Todd's birthday.
That's right. She's flashing back to things that you never see in the movie, right?
Yeah.
True, yeah.
So it's interesting. Oh, by the way, folks, this movie has been Bambi-ized further because it's just like Bambi with its sequel being a midquel. Fox and the Hound 2 also is a midquel. Happens in that, remember we were talking, they don't actually play much in the movie? They play in Fox and the Hound 2. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. That, I'm sure that's pretty much all they do, because in the middle of the movie, what else would they be able to do?
Not much, no.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I mean, this is one of those, like you've said about, like, Pete's Dragon and others, Todd. Like, this is one of those that I grew up and I saw multiple times. It was one that they would run on weekends on the local TV station. So when I was a kid, I saw this one a lot. I saw it in the theater. You know, this is one that I had a fond remembrance of. And when I went back and watched it now as an adult and then read about all the stuff that was going on, I was like, oh, this isn't nearly as good as I remembered.
It's an interesting movie. I kind of like what, you know, I don't dislike watching it and I don't not enjoy it. It's just not, you're right. It's definitely one of those where the memories of it are much better than the actual movie probably is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, yeah, that's not to say it's not bad. I mean, or not good rather. It's just, it's not, it, when I remembered it on par with maybe like, you know, some of the, not the 90s films, but the, you know, the better second tier Disney films, not Beauty and the Beast level, but under that. And it's not quite that. It's not quite that good.
No. Yeah, I would agree with that.
But it is a tearjerker. That's for sure.
It's got a lot of moments in it. Yes, it does.
How much did you cry, Brie?
Well, I would say a good 5 times.
That's a full box?
Maybe, actually, probably 1 tissue for each cry. So 5 tissues, I would say. It wasn't that bad.
Oh, that's not bad.
The scene where she drove him off to release him and the look on his face, like, where are we going, Mommy? That just killed me. I was done for. When you have a dog and you know the look on their face, no.
Yeah.
And the end, even the end, where you can hear their voices when they were younger, like, that got to me, too. It was the, ugh. Yeah.
You're verklempt.
I'm verklempt.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
So...
All right, so it's The Fox and the Hound. It's definitely one I would go see, if for nothing else, the historical value of it, like we mentioned at the beginning of the show about the transition between the two. But, you know, we'll see. See what you folks think. The Blu-ray's out now, so rent it or pick it up on Netflix and see what you think.
Oh, wait, there's no Star Wars connection in this movie.
Ugh.
I know. Isn't that sad?
No, but it's got Grandpa from Willy Wonka.
Not the same.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't have the...
He was the voice of Slade, by the way. The voice of Slade was Grandpa in Willy Wonka, which was cool, I thought.
Yeah. Definitely a lack of the Force, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Cheryl, because of its lack of a Star Wars connection, I assume you're giving it a 1.
I think I'm giving the 1.5.
Didn't like it, eh?
I mean, it was fine, but, I mean... You have so much to judge it against...
Yeah.
And so you judge it against even like something like I gave the example Brother Bear. I mean, I thought that was a better movie than this.
I would agree, Brother Bear. It's a better
I agree,
movie.
Yeah.
So I'd have to judge it against its peers.
All right, Todd. You gonna rate it higher?
You know, I like you saying, Ryan, I have a nostalgic issue with this because this was the movie where my dad was so excited when this came out because the main character of the movie had the same name as me, you know, the whole 9 yards, right? Mm-hmm. And even though we don't spell it the same way. You know, so I have memories like that. But I still, you know, watching it now, I have to go with what I feel now. You know, not so much right. Then with a little bit of the nostalgia thrown in. So I think that I would... Including my extra for nostalgia, I think I'm at a 2.5 for this. You know, I would not watch it,
right.
But it's not my first choice either.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And it's not a desert island.
Brie? No. Brie, your thoughts?
I'm going to have to agree with Todd and give this a 2.5. For the quality of the film, I would give it 3.5, actually. But because it makes me an absolute mess... And it probably just took like 5 years off my life. I'm going to give it a 2.5. It's definitely not one that I will watch for a very long time. I think the suspense, because of not knowing what was coming next, was more bothersome than anything else. But because not knowing who was going to die, you know, what's going to happen here. But yeah, it didn't do much for me. Meh.
Mm, what about I can hear you. Yeah. Well, like I said, going into it, I thought that I would, not that I was going to love it, but that it would be, you know, a solid 3 or maybe a 3.5 or something, and it really wasn't. I mean, I had this on DVD already, and was considering, I watched it to say, you know, do I want to upgrade this to Blu-ray or not? And yeah, I'm not going to. There's things I like about it. There's stuff that I enjoy, but as a whole, no, I didn't really enjoy it this time through. So I was going to give it a 2. I might have to throw on an extra half like Todd and you, just for sentimentality reasons, but I think I'm going to stick with my 2. I actually, even after watching it this time, considered, you know what, I don't really need this in my life. I might give this DVD away.
Yeah.
If it weren't for my obsessive compulsive need to own all the animated films, I would probably get rid of it. But I do have that obsessive compulsive need, so I'm going to hang on to it. But yeah, I would have to give it a 2.
Fair enough.
All right, so that will do it for our look at The Fox and the Hound. We hope you have enjoyed the show more than we enjoyed the movie. So go take a look at it if you want. I mean, if you haven't seen it, I think we would all, again, like usual, except for Beverly Hills Chihuahua, we would usually recommend seeing the movie, if for nothing else, some of the historical aspects. Am I right here?
Yeah, yes. Oh, no, I think people should see it. I mean, just, you know, be aware of what you're getting into. You know, that's if you've listened to the podcast first, that's all.
Yeah.
Have your tissues beside you, and you might shake your fist a couple times, but it happens.
Yeah, maybe Tiki Room style.
Yeah.
You never know.
Oh, yeah.
Although I have to unshake it now. I have to come down there and unshake the fist now that they have
the Tiki
Room.
I want
to
be there at the unshaking ceremony.
Me too.
It'll be in October. I will have an unshaking ceremony. Yeah. But that'll do it for The Fox and the Hound. For the rest of the week, your task is to keep in touch with us across all of the various and sundry social networks. Go to Facebook and look for Disney Film Project and like us there. We're getting close to 100 people. I'm very excited. If we could just get about 50 more. No, that's not true. About 20 more people, I think, and we would be at 100.
That's right. So have your mom sign up.
And keep looking for us there. And then look for us on Twitter. Let us know what you think of the show, at Diz Film Project. You can look for us there and let us know what you think of the show. You can comment in the show notes. If you go to DisneyFilmProject.com, there's a comment right at the bottom. You can say, hey, I really like this show, or I can't believe you people made me watch this movie. I cried so much. Whatever you think, do that. Go to iTunes, where you can get the podcast, and leave us a review. We really appreciate those. It helps us know if we're on the right track, or if you guys want to see something else, just let us know. Let us know what you want to see on the show, or hear, rather, since you can't actually see us. That's fine. And make sure, remember, if you're out and about, Stitcher Radio, you can listen to the show on that as well. And then there's blogging. There's lots of blogging going on. You can read my blogs at DisneyFilmProject.com. On TouringPlans.com, you see Todd and myself. And then DisneyDrivenLife.com. I mean, come on. There you got Bree with her attractions blogging. You got me throwing up some films every now and then. You got Todd, who's making it all possible. I mean, it's all right there for you people. So go to these websites and support them. By supporting them, you're supporting us. And that's very supportive of you.
And
we appreciate it.
You can sometimes find Todd and I in the parks if you find us.
That's right.
Say
you,
hi.
You can koala stalk us as Todd Perlmutter and Sarah Perlmutter.
I'm going to do that now.
Nope. If you koala stalk me, I do not always say the correct location I am at. That's the warning.
Yeah, Cheryl's got the drive-by check-in thing going on.
I am going to Twitter koala stalk the two of you when I come down. So just be prepared. All right. But until next week, folks, we are the best of friends, so we will see you later.
Bye.
Later on.